I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings as part of our Penn Sound Archive, writing.upenn.edu/PennSound. Today, I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Danny Snelson, editor of Ubu Editions at UbuWeb. Are you still editor of Ubu Editions, or is that old?
I think it's old.
It's old. Well, he was editor of Ubu Editions at UbuWeb, and the stuff is still there. Contributing editor to Penn Sound, curator of the innovative Edit series here at the Writer's House, the new reissues editor for Jacket 2, who has blogged and archived under the title J. Henry Chunko, Writing, Sounds, Digital Ephemera, whose projects include a fraudulent digital reproduction of a book by Juno Barnes, originally republished in 1948. And by Sarah Dowling, a Saskatchewanian. Do we say that?
Something like that.
Saskatchewanian. International editor of Jacket 2, with recent academic stints at Temple University and here at Penn, whose work has appeared in How To, Envision, Q, The Mitre, West Coast Line, and elsewhere, and who, with Charles Bernstein, co-curated North of Invention, a gathering of experimental Canadian poets, the recordings of which audio and video are available on Penn Sound. And by Michael Golston, who teaches at Columbia University, specializes in 20th century poetry, poetics, and modern cultural history, whose essays are everywhere, including two collections, American Modernism Across the Arts and New Definitions of Lyric, Theory, Technology, and Culture, and whose first book, Rhythm and Race in Modernist Poetry and Science, won the Louis Martz Prize of 2007, and whose current book project is about allegory, surrealism, and postmodern poetic form. Is that still true?
That is absolutely true.
Great. Thank you so much, Michael, for coming down from New York today. And Danny and Sarah, hello. Welcome back to the third floor of the Writer's House.
Yeah.
It's good to see you both. Sarah, hi.
Hi.
Back from, fresh from Vancouver. Well, today, the four of us are going to be talking about two short poems of P. Inman from a book called At Least, At Dot Least, or At Period Least, which was published by Krupskaya in 1999. The two poems are entitled Reception Theory, dedicated to Diane Ward, and Lacey, L-A-C, bracket E-Y, which is dedicated to Tom Raworth. Our recording of Inman reading these poems dates from a visit he made here in March of 2005, so here now is P. Inman reading Reception Theory and then Lacey.
Reception Theory for Diane Ward. Unemployment rate too short than any raccoon, too imagist those any synonyms. Hornbull, Alec, paulist each road endlessness from it. The same Irish from Mudge nerves, the wine edges behind a verb. She was only some drove herself, trying to convince De Niro about which Atlantic. Poverts, nerve, saunch, etc. Where would snowfall about Goodman Brown? A cav ep of river, a car park any size of limes. Lacey for Tom Raworth. A less into taupe-walled commas gelatin. Let's call this my age, leaning into some dream. The further he moves away, the more surfaces, the longer they end as her midst. My nose of all recourse shaped trouble upon Siecla. My polk midge.
Somebody want to describe the poems on the page? I imagine that, I know we're going to be talking about the difference between the way it reads and the way it sounds. Michael, do you mind describing it?
Sure. They're set off in, they're in stanzas, short stanzas.
They almost look like hemi-stitches. Every line is divided in the middle with about a three space distance. And one thing I was noticing was very interesting was that they seem to situate on the page according to the right margin. In other words, the right justified margin is where the longest of the lines on the right side of the poem basically situate, and that's then determines where the poem falls on the page. So there was an interesting moment there.
So he's obviously thought a lot about the way it appears on the page.
And
I mean, that's sort of an obvious thing to say, but I hadn't thought of this thing about the justification. I mean, that's really particular.
Yes, I think with a lot of Inman's poems, the more you look at them, the more complicated they become formally. So that again, if you look at the two pages there of that first poem, the poems are actually situated not in the middle of the page, but off to the right slightly. And again, it's the spacing on the page is determined entirely by the longest line of the second hemi stitch, so to speak.
So Sarah, reading it, you think, oh, there's tons of hesitation. There's got to be a kind of disjunctive, slowed down reading experience. But then listening to him, he elides a lot of it.
Yeah, I would say that's really true, because when you see it on the page, it looks quite sculptural. Mm-hmm. You know, you have these two columns, as Michael was saying, and they're not quite equal to each other. Sometimes the left one, there seems to be more of it than the right one, and sometimes the right one, the lines in it seem to be a bit longer. So maybe on the horizontal axis, there's more of it, whereas on the vertical axis, there's more of the left column.
So what's lost when he simply elides in and jams? I'm thinking in the Raworth poem, the poem to Raworth, he gets to, the further he moves away, the more surfaces, the longer they end. That's really, he reads it straight through.
Yeah.
And yet, looking at it on the page, there are periods after all the words on the left, well, basically after all the words.
Yeah.
So he reads through the periods. Danny, your thought on what
well,
we
course,
should do?
Well, of course, I mean, I think the two-column format also opens up vertical readings along with horizontal readings.
How often does he do the vertical reading? I saw only once, but am I wrong?
He does it once. I don't know if he's reading from an earlier draft or something, but he doesn't read exactly with the poem. There's a number of articles that are
the very
kind of
beginning
around.
Of Lacey, he reads
right.
down,
yeah.
a less into taupe-walled commas gelatin. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it would read a taupe-walled less commas into gelatin. Has he determined that, or is he just going with it in the performance?
I think it would be open. I think what's nice about the poems is they leave a space open for a reader to explore or to read the poem, I guess, how they would like. And this encouraged vertical reading. So I did vertical readings along with horizontal readings, and that opened up a number of, I think...
You did as you were reading
As I was
and
reading
thinking.
It on the page. And I think that what Mike highlights about the book aspect is really important as well, which you wouldn't get in an electronic reproduction, the fact that it sits close to the gutter, mm-hmm. The way that they hang on the page is actually... further destabilizes and opens up those wide white spaces to yeah. the left of the poem and to the right yeah. of the poem around the gutter. So,
yeah.
Michael, Peter Inman has written about and talked about, I'm going to formulate this in an easy way, why he does this or what purpose he's trying to achieve. Mm-hmm. Leaving all that aside, what would you encountering this work, not just these poems but others, what would you say to a student, for instance, who said, you know, Professor Gulston, how do I deal with this?
Well, that is a question very dear to my heart, I must say.
I know, that's why I asked.
Yeah, I love to give students Peter Inman and with no introduction and just send them home and say, please read this. And what I ask them to do is just to describe it, because I think there's some point at which you have to start really with a kind of, you know, sort of just verbalize where it is, what sort of vocabulary is being construed, and then how the form is actually perhaps functioning, whether one should actually read the form, I mean, whether these forms signify in some kind of a way. There's a way in which I think, if nothing else, a student might come to the conclusion that a poem like Lacey is about margins, it's about edges, it's about things like gutters, and it's about things like like what a page is and how one might kind of construe it. So I think the fun and the more than the fun, the marvel of Inman is just the incredible kinds of readerly experiences one can actually have from him. And I have to say, I feel like he repays constant reading. One comes back to Inman, you know, continually.
Danny, your thought on this?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think, and coming back from all sorts of different vistas and viewpoints, I think, I mean, and the poems are both ostensibly about that. I mean, reception theory, I guess, really each of the stanzas addresses, I think, a different viewpoint on the way that a reader can engage with these poems in a kind of open-ended way, and the way that the words can turn on themselves in all sorts of different forms.
Unemployment rate too short than any raccoon. Two imagist those any synonyms. Hornbull, Alec. Paulist each road endlessness from it.
Sarah, the book was published in 1999, and it happened that Peter Inman came to this very same Kelly Writers House in 1999 to do a Philly Talks. And in Philly Talks, he described his poetics, or he enumerated some ideas which were very languagey, I must say. Some of them fit perfectly, such as an example, one word does not equal another, language is not a medium of equivalence. So these kinds of things that we're at this point used to hearing from the late 70s through the 80s. But he also said some things that seem now to be glosses on what he was working on. And I'll quote, and then just ask you to react, starting with Sarah. Over-punctuation as one available strategy, he said, over-punctuation, to contract, to slow down the text, to counteract the socially constructed tendency to move through the present word to the next as quickly as possible, in other words, to slow it down. And then he said, read Taylorism, which is perfect for him because of his political concerns associated with the way we have to do work. And then he writes, to neutralize punctuation's directive function. Yeah. So I invite you just to say anything in response to that, starting with Sarah.
Well, I looked over his notes on slow writing from Philly Talks as well, because that series is so kind of close to my heart, and I thought it would be a nice place to begin as I was getting ready to come talk with you guys about these poems. And one thing that really struck me in Notes for Slow Writing is, like you were saying, it is really quite languagey in a way that we've kind of absorbed at this point, but...
And we're referring to language poetry or language writing.
Yeah, exactly.
We were just being coy.
As we so often are.
In other words, some of the statements sound manifesto-like from that moment.
Yeah, but what really surprised me about it was how many of them were not familiar in that way. So, for example, I think pretty near the beginning of that statement that he wrote, he talks about the idea of depth and how we can think about depth without it being a kind of psychologizing term. There are other kinds of depth, and he talks about social depth rather than personal depth. And I thought that was such an interesting statement reading both of these poems, because, of course, each of them is dedicated to somebody who presumably is a close friend. And I found that especially interesting in the case of the Lacey poem. And I guess coming where I come from, I assumed that Lacey must be a woman's name. So I thought it was kind of neat to have the E in square brackets. But then as I read some other things about the poem, I realized that actually the title was probably more likely to be referring to the saxophonist Steve Lacey, who, of course, was a really close friend of Tom Raworth. And the title of one of his albums, Let's Call This, is also in the poem. So all of a sudden it seemed like there was this really interesting model of kind of social depth rather than psychological depth at work in these poems. And they seem to be, like, very densely networked. There was so much in them that was about these kind of social groups, about these different kind of artistic groups, groups of friends that are also groups of thinkers who are in these very close, very intense conversations.
A less into taupe-walled commas gelatin. Let's call this my age, leaning into some dream. The further he moves away, the more surfaces, the longer they end as her midst. My nose of all recourse shaped trouble upon Siecla. My polk midge.
So then, as I read through the notes for the Philly Talks event again, each time he started talking about over-punctuation as a way of slowing things down, it seemed like it wasn't just slowing things down in terms of thinking about, say, the materiality of language, how does language actually work? It seemed like a way of kind of slowing down and crystallizing these moments in a social network, not just a linguistic network, like slowing down and crystallizing these moments of, say, listening to a record that someone who's either your own really good friend or the friend of your really good friend had created, and the kinds of thinking that would go on through and around that friendship. And it seemed all of a sudden that those ideas that have come to seem familiar from language writing all of a sudden had this new resonance when you start thinking about them in terms of, you know, a group of intense friends and the ways in which we might slow that down, really think about that in its sort of particularities.
Interesting take on it. I mean, one of the blurbs on the book, and this was meant positively because you don't put negative blurbs on books, clinically cold and unerringly humane. So kind of an easy blurby paradox.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it seemed right. The humane, I think you were speaking in part to the humane part.
Yeah.
Michael, what's your thought on the reference to Taylorism in parentheses as a cognate field in which we want to slow down in resistance to the effort to make us speed up? Are you interested in that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is an ongoing, I guess, at least, again, I think you're right to periodize what's going on here, because I think that this was a principal concern of Peter's in the 80s, and, you know, even a little bit earlier. And he is very interested in, again, these Taylorist models, not only for social production, but also obviously for text. I mean, that the moving from left to right, once again, to get back to the idea of the margins, that you have a particular kind of writing that comes out of Capital to some extent. And he sees a lot of his work, I think, as an intervention therein.
Mm-hmm.
I would say one thing about the really interesting comments about the slowing down of the text and that sort of estrangement that happens when a period appears at the end of every word, which is weirdly, I think, almost normative way that he read the text seems like it works very much against that kind of slowing down. So here again, there's perhaps in the text, there's a sort of formally insisted upon slowing down, which then the performance of the text moves into this other kind of social register. It almost
sounded conversational. Which, based on Sarah's reading, might be, oh, I almost hate to say this, but might be a warming up to the social networking that's part of this, or to the referentiality. That makes me like the work all the more, that it starts with this resistance to speed up, but then as he owns it and performs it, he starts to live with it, and it takes on its own natural life. Danny, what are you thinking about here?
Well, in relation to this, and also the question you raised about language poetry, there's been two really insightful articles, one by Mark Wallace and then one by Craig Dworkin, around Pienman and language writing, and the way that he hasn't been... that these works, for example, aren't anthologized, aren't included in a lot of the
they aren't, and yet I think it's Wallace who says, I'm sorry for interrupting, I think it's Wallace who says, or someone says, Inman is really consistent. He's still doing this in a way that many of the other people of that movement, so-called, have gone off to do other things. What do you take from that? That's a good thing, I think.
That's exactly what's so exciting, I think, is also that, you know, in the language writing moment, that there is, that this poetry is embedded in that as well as a historical operation that Peter Pienman has been continued to experiment with since the 70s, and in a relatively consistent way, that the slowness and the play with performance in reading a text are still experimented with in the same way.
What are the literary politics of that? I didn't say the politics, because Inman has a lot to say about that, but the literary politics of him sticking with a project that he seems to think is still relevant.
I would say this. I know that there's he himself periodizes his work around an early interest in minimalism, and I kept coming back to this title "At Least" as a kind of statement about a minimal kind of a text of some sort.
What do you think "at least" means?
Well, I read it almost like in the sense of Clark Coolidge's "At Egypt." In other words, trying to get at least, I mean, with the obvious other meaning of, well, at least where I'm doing this as opposed to something else.
The bare minimum.
Yeah, I mean, there's a way, I think, in which these two texts almost operate like a Barnett Newman painting. I mean, we have that stripe down the middle, which is basically, you know, it's here, it's constructed by these phrases and words on either side, but this consistent kind of very, very minimalist sort of, if this could be an analog for that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, this may get us back to your pedagogical point where you're talking about dealing, you know, asking your students to go home. It seems to me that our colleagues in the visual arts who are teaching in the visual arts have it over us, because they can say, you know, look at this, you know, analytic cubist painting, and there's really not much else you can do but to grasp the form. And you can't try to do anything else. I mean, you maybe can see a Picasso woman sitting on a chair, but it's not going to help you much. Whereas with here, I mean, and Sarah actually proves the value of figuring out some kind of referentiality to it. But here, you know, you're always looking at semantic meaning. It keeps creeping in. Let me just throw out another Inmanian statement, and any one of you can respond to it. Picasso, he says, reportedly said that painting's role was to arrest motion, which is his thing here, Inman's, the better to isolate form's possibility. Aren't we always trying to encourage our friends who are new to poetry and poetics, or our students, to derive something from isolating form's possibility? What is this? What's the effect of that here? What's good about it?
Well, I would say that Charles Bernstein actually makes this point in Artifice of Absorption, I believe it is, where he talks about Inman's poems as you sort of have to flip your kind of readerly habits when you read an Inman poem, partly obviously because they're so demolished just on the level of syntax and so forth, but also because one almost has to work out a kind of a meaning for the form before one actually can read the poem.
Right.
And I think that that's, I think Inman's just brilliant at sort of switching this kind of node where all of a sudden we have to ask the question, what is this big white stripe down the middle, and why are these things, you know, marginated in this kind of interesting way, and so forth?
Well, we could talk about this for a long time. Why don't I just go around and ask each of you to say one last thing that you meant to say but didn't have a chance to in this relatively brief discussion. Danny, you have one thing to say?
Following up on Mike's last comment, also, I wanted to highlight the Philly Talks, and there's one passage I thought particularly interesting in terms of reception and reading and the production of these forms. So Inman says, every act along the line becomes one of reception. The loss of the distinction between writing and reading makes the writing of, say, Tenor Buttons an act of consumption rather than production. I think that form-opening possibility has quite a bit to do with his notion of setting up a form in which the act of producing a text is one of consuming or reading a text at the same time.
Great. Thank you. Sarah?
One thing I wanted to point to was from reception theory. It's actually a passage right after the one that Danny was discussing a moment ago. And I think it really illustrates the sort of less theoretical pleasures of the text other than the ones we've been discussing so far. So the lines go, the same Irish from Mudge nerves, the wine edges behind a verb. And all of a sudden, the poem, in spite of this very kind of clinical, cold visual appearance we've been discussing, lapses into a sort of absolutely traditional rhythm with some kind of weird off rhymes. And you just get this really funny image of the wine edges behind a verb. And, you know, it just seems like this little joke about kind of being drunk while writing or something like that.
I really like contemporary poetry for this very reason,
because
in the old days, they wrote very formal poetry that rhymed until they got drunk, and then they had some fun, and that's the stuff we like. Now, you know, you go into this having destroyed the whole thing, and then it gets reconstructed when you get a little loose.
Yeah.
So
definitely.
I like the way the wine has an effect on P. Inman. We're doing some guessing there.
Yeah.
Michael, your final thought on this?
Well, I was fascinated with the title Lacey. I also figured out that it had something to do with Steve Lacey, and not only Lacey's album, but Lacey's, it's a monk tune. So Lacey, it's Lacey playing a monk tune, which once again takes us back into this kind of socius that you were pointing out really interestingly. But I also think that it's a description in many ways of the way the form of this particular poem works. It's almost like a lacing. In other words, mm-hmm. there's a sense, and here again, when he read it down and then up, it's almost like you could kind of visualize this as a sort of lacing that's going on, in the sense that the lines lace together and unlace and so forth and so on. And the last thing I'll say is, it was interesting, I feel like these two poems, I'm glad we chose these two poems, because they bookend this book, and I do think that Inman often writes books as much as he writes poems. These are the only two poems in this book that have this characteristic form. Everything else is different.
Yeah, and I guess this is a way of recommending that Poem Talk fans pick up at least and read the whole thing. Because it really does, it does read it all as a whole, and we extracted one part of it for this Poem Talk. I guess I'm going to take the final word. I just wanted to finish up my thought on Taylorism. I'm really completely persuaded by this. I think... I'm going to be very general. I think we read too fast. I don't think we pay attention. I think there's a lot of crucial life and death things that we're reading about in our world, and the way people work, the way people live, and we skim past it because we're taught to do it, you know, as you were saying. Left to right, eyes moving fast, get the main thing. And it turns out that the main thing is probably not something we're going to see if we skim too much. The way things are constructed, the naturalization of syntax and all that stuff. And one of the things that writing like this does is to slow us down, to trip us up, to make us not comfortable. And Taylorism really is the analogy. It's a bit old, you know, it's a real 20th century kind of thing, speed up, you know, working in a factory and being told to go faster. It is resistance. It's an overused metaphor in the literary world, but it is a form of resistance to read slowly or to mess up when you're reading, mm-hmm. and this is one way to do it. Well, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of gathering paradise, which is a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. Who wants to gather paradise? Sarah Dowling, you have the visage of someone who wants to gather, or you've been to paradise and back.
Well, I was
Vancouver.
Just in Vancouver. Yeah.
Where you were well received.
I hope so. I think so. It felt that way. I will gather some paradise for Holly Melgard, who is a young poet up in Buffalo. She's the incoming editor of PQ, which is a great print journal. And she has a lot of really interesting work up online. She just did a little section for C.A. Conrad's Jupiter 88, which you can find on YouTube. And everyone should go Google her name. She's got a lot of great stuff on the internet.
And will you spell it?
Holly Melgard.
Terrific. Danny Snelson, gather some paradise.
The thing I've been most interested in lately is a piece called Semiospectacle by Machin Coference, which is trafficking around both online and in production. It's a kind of performance piece that brings together theater and poetry across virtual and real spaces. So keep an eye out for that online and around.
Great. Thank you, Danny. Michael.
Okay, well, the big news is that there's going to the press, if P then Q, is going to be publishing two volumes collected P. Inman.
No kidding.
Yes, I'm not kidding. No, I'm not kidding.
Who's editing?
Craig Dworkin, no less, one of the great thinkers about Inman. And this is, I think, hugely exciting because so much of Inman's work has been completely inaccessible
hard
and out of
find.
Print.
Hard
so. This is going
to
be a major thing.
That's terrific. It seems to me whenever Danny Snelson is in this room, I'm always saying something good about what he's doing. So I'll just gather some paradise. He is the reissues editor of Jacket 2, and he's doing some marvelous things, Dworkin-like in some ways.
Can we plug Craig's Perverse Library?
Okay, go ahead.
Straight out from Information's material, this beautiful book. The library is hosted by the Stern House in England, but... Really a gorgeous publication. And I'm sure and there's plenty of Inman in the Perverse
you're
Library.
Also yeah. very good at deflecting flattery and praise. You know, he wouldn't let me. Well, anyway, that's all the over-punctuation we have time for in Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Danny Snelson, Sarah Dowling, and Michael Galston, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer, James Lamar, and to our editor, as always, Steve McLaughlin. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for another Poem Talk.